Hello, and welcome to Studio Sessions, the big red and shiny podcast where we talk with artists about the ideas, inspiration, and processes that go into their work. I'm your host, Matt Kuhlman, and this episode I'll be speaking with Hannah Verlin. Hannah earned her BFA from the School of the Museum of Fine Arts in Boston in 2005. Her work often involves a strong element of historical or documentary research, which she then turns into projects that bring little-known bits of history and information to the viewer's attention. In one recent work, she creates pieces based off of information found in the logs of whaling ships from a museum in New Bedford, Massachusetts. In another project, she makes a piece that chronicles the destruction of a devastating molasses flood in Boston that occurred just over 100 years ago. Her projects also often have interactive qualities to them, such as placing text on a walkway for pedestrians to follow and read along, or actually inviting people to take parts of the installation with them. Join me as Hannah discusses the information she finds that creates the foundation for her projects, and how she chooses to purvey this information to her audience. Hi, Hannah. How you doing?
I'm good. How are you, Matt?
Good. Thanks for being here with me.
Oh, well, thank you for coming.
And so we're here in your studio in the Brick Bottom building, and you got a lot of little things around. We could start just by picking out some of the projects you have going on right now.
Okay. Well, I'm I am getting ready for a show in September that I'm calling Fates and Furies American History. So it's taking all these elements of American history that I find fascinating and see as sort of epic sagas that, you know, carry through today, and just exploring them using a lot of handwritten text.
Okay.
I have a bunch of roles.
Is that what all these little...
Yeah, they're... let's see. So some of those things that I'm looking at are particularly whaling, and I did this residency at the New Bedford Whaling Museum where I was collecting texts to transcribe. And I have a whole bunch of rolls of paper that there's red text written on them.
And it looks kind of like blood. Is that
intentional? Yeah. So what it is the text there is from shipping manifests from the 1830s in New Bedford, and what that was it would list all the ships that went out and the details of their voyage. So it would say, you know, they went out on such and such date and they took, you know, such and such barrels of oil on this day and such barrels of oil on this date, and then at the end of their voyage they had this many barrels of oil. So it's sort of documenting this sort of path of destruction that they've led. So that piece will eventually, the rolls are 1 to 3 foot, 3.5 foot strips of paper that will go, they'll be stretched across a corner of a room to become kind of like this hanging carcass of that's loosely a whale, but it slightly references, you know, a body. And they're, you know, sort of these strips of blood and text and words. And then I have another series of, they're the same width, they're black and white rolls. Mm-hmm. And that is also material that I gathered from the New Bedford Whaling Museum. It has a log book of a captain, sort of. And they have so many logbooks that are just like, the winds were out of the west today. Mm-hmm. We spied one whale. My truth hurts. Like, so each of those has the entries, and I stain half of the page, you know, with Sumi ink, and the other half is white, and then in between is written the text, and those will hang vertically on the wall, so they kind of reference whale baleen. And I'll be doing something else with crew lists, again, with sort of loosely referencing the shape of a whale, but that one will be more about the people that were victims to of this industry. And my interest in whaling is, it's just such an interesting, complex theme that it's man going out to, you know, kill the beast on this many-year voyage. It's very...
one of the biggest animals on the planet.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, they just saw them as commodities, but now we know that they rhyme, have complex social structures. And it's hard to, you know, put the two together where they see them as, you know, basically like, you know, product. Versus us that, you know, sort of see them as these amazing, you know, fellow creatures. But it's also, you know, it's mythic and epic, and it's tied to the Industrial Revolution, since it was whale oil that was basically, you know, it was lighting people's homes up, and it was, you know, lubricating literally the wheels of industry. So it has, you know, myth and industry, which I feel like is... America all in one.
Yeah, it's also chronicled in Moby Dick. I think most people, including myself, haven't even read, but we understand the gist of it, like, just through reference of hearing it so many times.
Yeah, I just started reading it, and I'm slowly plodding through. I don't really care for Melville's writing. Like, he's too...
Yeah, I've never gotten into it. It's such a big book, and it's such an old book that I'm already, like, familiar with the themes that... I'll get to it someday.
It's kind of sentimental, and he's sort of, but it is very dated. But it's still like he's seeing the only the mythic part of the whaling in a way that it's, you know, it's the journey of the hero that you go out and you slay the beast, or the beast slays you. But he's sort of like, in some ways, he's a product of his time, and he can't step back almost and see, you know, what it is that they're actually doing, and the things that are, you know, terrible about the industry, and I don't know. So I'm not as crazy about Melville as my love for whaling would make you think.
And it's also an industry that's, you know, on this half of the continent, very specific to New England and the Northeast. Are you from this region, and that's what draws you to it?
I grew up outside of Philadelphia. Also a colonial city, but there...
Not so many whales down there.
Not as many whales. I mean, still, you know, connected to the sea, and I love the Atlantic Ocean, and, like, see the Atlantic Ocean as part of, you know, also this mythic view of American history, of this lifeline that... Not even a lifeline, but a... Almost a frontier in and of itself. That it's, like, the frontier, like, our... Eastern frontier opposed to the Western frontier. But yeah, like, yeah, no, so defined by whaling here that it is part of it. And certainly most of the pieces I'm working on, like, draw on New England history.
Just, what are some other aspects that you're working with besides the whaling pieces?
Well, right now I'm also gaga for the Battle Hymn of the Republic, which is this, let's see. It's the everybody knows, like, glory, glory, hallelujah, glory, you know, soul is marching on. So it was a song composed by this woman in the North who was an abolitionist and went in the papers and became the song that the Union Army, you know, sang as they marched forth into battle. And I think if you... First of all, the lyrics are truly incredible. Such amazing things as, you know, he's trampling out the vintage where the grapes of wrath are stored, or as he died to make men holy, let us die to make men free. And I think that that song and that sort of sensibility of being sort of holy warriors going off to liberate men like God, you know, liberated men, something that has stayed in American culture, or is, you know, is so quintessential to it. It was maybe it was there all along, but it's like I see it in, you know, all, you know, like the invasion of Iraq and Afghanistan. Yeah. Like you really, it's
even
really,
back then it was totally wrong, because if they really wanted the South to be free, they would have left them alone and let them go make their own country.
Yeah, no, yeah, it's like.
They're, recapturing them in the name of freedom.
Yeah. Exactly. It's like this weird logic of violence to make freedom, but you're so that it's crusading, yeah, like, all over again. And
having such a strong conviction that you're right.
Uh-huh.
And that's what drives it again.
Yeah, and that it's a holy virtue, but it's a political virtue. That's why it's, I find it funny. Like, it's summed up all in the name, the Battle Hymn of the Republic. It's a battle song, but it's a hymn, and it's the Republic, so, like... You can just pick that part forever. And I see it in Manifest Destiny, too. So, and Manifest Destiny, the building of the railroad. So, I'm laying out a piece, like, right here, which is a 15-inch by 6-foot strip of paper, where I'm going to be doing a small circles that I'll write in the lyrics of Battle Hymn of the Republic, and... I'll have one set in black and one set in red, and they'll be across the room from each other, and they'll be kind of like these bullet holes, or like the barrel of a gun and then the bullet hole. And I've also worked on a book that uses the lyrics to make sort of this cascade of blood, with red ink. And I really like working with the song lyrics because they're so immediate. It's something that people recognize, that, you know, everybody knows. They might not really know that song, but they've heard the words, and it has, you know, just by singing those lyrics, and you have a connection between you and the people that sung it 200 years ago, or 100 years ago. I'm not entirely...
About 169.
Okay, all right, I'll round up. Math, not so good for me.
So these circles you have drawn up here, they're about the size of, like, a nickel or a dime. Are you trying to fit all of the words into each circle?
No, it'll get broken up, so there'll be fragments of the song.
But is it going to be, like, super tiny writing?
Yeah, most of my writing is very tiny. I can bring out some stuff to look at, maybe just to help you with questions. So this is a book that I'm working on that has... On one side, I've written the text comes from the vital records of early Boston from 1630 to 1730. And one side, I've written the births, and one side, I've written the deaths. So the way that it looks, they're written very, very small, and there's just a little bit of white space in between them that becomes like a... like a sound wave or a heart monitor.
If I'm like 3 feet away, I can't even really see.
No.
The text is like a fuzz.
Yeah, the
it's
text,
like static.
It just becomes... And it's all handwritten, and although it's not... the text, it's not calligraphy in any sense. I feel like it's very important that it is handwritten because it's so much about the time that got put into it and my own... you know, sort of meditation on the name, that somehow by reading it and writing it down, there's, you know, some sort of magical transmutation that happens, that changes it completely if it were, let's say, just printed out. That I feel...
Yeah, it wouldn't be as interesting an object if it were just printed.
I mean, certainly it's the difference between an illuminated manuscript, I feel like, and maybe, like, you might have a Gutenberg Bible, which you're like, wow, it's a Gutenberg Bible, but, you know, it doesn't have that same sense of immediacy of, you know, the person's hand and the
and
time.
Before the printing press, like, people actually had to transcribe all the time. That was like a skill that people cultivated, and that was, like, all they did.
Yeah, and it's... It's really interesting, you know, switching from, you know, just type in real life and having autocorrect and things like that, and then switching to transcription. It's such a different mindset. And I'll be like, wait a minute, how do I spell that word? And especially if I'm transcribing, and there's always a point when I start out and it's very difficult to do, and then I sort of get in the flow of it. Or certainly with the handwriting, I find that, like, my own personal handwriting is very bad. But when I'm doing the art writing, it's a different set of handwriting.
Okay.
And if I suddenly, let's say, I need to, like, sign a check or something, if between the art writing and real writing, like, my hand will just go stupid, and it'll just, like, how do you work?
I was going to say, it's the tiny letters, but they're very legible. Like, you can see my handwriting here. It's not that great.
Well, some of my handwriting is not legible. I mean, it depends what I'm writing for. Mm-hmm. Like, this book. I don't want to unfold the whole thing, but...
Yeah, that one's a lot more freeform.
Yeah, so this is a blue...
It looks intentionally so.
Yeah, it's blue text that is kind of like a wave going all over this accordion book. And mm-hmm. it's the names and sort of data associated with clipper ships made in Medford. So if I spread it all out, you would sort of see it start out as a trickle, and then become like a huge mass, and then it trickles out again, which replicates what happened in Medford, where they were building, you know, they started building a few ships, and then they were just building hundreds of them, and I just imagine these clipper ships, you know, setting off over the world, and, you know, that their trading was both productive and destructive. You know, they're part of that triangle trade in a way, and that so much of that trade was, you know, directly or indirectly involved in, you know, blood and death.
Mm.
And speaking of blood and death, I did this book, which I've been working on a series of sort of thinking about fates. I've been doing these tiny skulls. And I worked on and completed this book, which is just tiny white skulls on black paper, again an accordion book, that are sort of accumulated together in huge piles, filling up the page, and...
That's several thousand skulls.
Yeah, and I was doing... I did most of this, I would do, like, if I had half an hour or something left at the studio, and I didn't really want to get too into a project before I left. But then during the lockdown that we just had, I, you know, spent the whole day working on this because I, you know, I just, you know, so wrapped up in the news, I didn't want to pay attention to anything, and it became this, rather than being necessarily about fate as I had thought, it was much more about death and pain, and it just changed by the context. It was kind of interesting. So, and sort of sent me off thinking about a whole different set of things related to the piles of skulls. I can show you some new piles of skulls.
Alright.
Isn't this a great Sunday morning, Matt? Okay. So, I'm working on a book that will be a sort of a like a fold-out book, not an accordion, where they get stacked together, about the molasses flood in Boston, but also thinking about molasses.
What's the molasses flood?
What?
What's the molasses
flood? Oh, it was incredible and devastating. It was one of the largest...
It was actual molasses?
Yes, it was one of the largest disasters in Boston. I believe it was 100 years old this year, so imagine in 1913 it happened, or about then, and there were huge vats that held molasses that was going to get made into rum, and they ruptured and filled the city with so much, you know, molasses that, you know, people drowned. It was really, like, and there were, it was extraordinarily terrible, you know, that... I'm not sure about what the fatalities were, but it was incredibly destructive, and, you know, the city was a sticky mess full of corpses for days, and it's something that is very amusing in the way that it sounds. You're like,
I need to go look this up now. There's got to be some photos.
Oh, there are, since it was 19, you know, it was the turn of the last century, or previous century. So, but I was thinking about, so these, it's translucent paper with tiny brown skulls that, for me, they suggest, you know, sort of like the death of molasses, like in molasses, and the like the flowing of it, the actual liquid. But then I also, I'm interested in how the, like, the North was as complicit in slavery by trade, you know, as, like, maybe the South was in, you know, actual practice.
Yeah.
So, and sort of bringing attention to that. So, like, for me, the skulls are brown, and that it thinks about, I'm thinking about those connections that even though that these were different eras, the molasses flood being, you know, in the early 1900s, but, you know, maybe those earlier associations that the molasses, the rum made in Massachusetts, like Medford, you know, that was, those were things that were bought with human blood. So just think about those connections. That's what I'm sort of interested in, sort of picking apart and exploring history, not necessarily in a linear way, but these jumps over time and making these connections.
Mm-hmm.
So, and certainly, again, like I like the meditative, you know, drawing one thing and another and the same thing over and over and over again, that process is, you know, very much part of it, you know, that each skull sort of like gets my attention for one moment.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I remember a few other text pieces I saw on your website.
Mm-hmm.
There was one where there was some yarn hanging down from the ceiling that spelled out something
mm-hmm.
on the floor.
Yeah, and that piece was called A New World, and I'm actually thinking, there's so many things in American history that it's like, oh, I want to explore that, and I want to explore that, so I'm glad you brought that up, because now I remember.
Just out of curiosity, did you, like, study history in school, or?
No, but I guess when I was in high school, there were two things I really loved. I really loved art, and I really loved history, and I, both are, you know,
mm-hmm.
highly big money-making fields. So it was like a toss-up, which I did.
Mm-hmm.
But in the end, I decided I wanted to go with art, and I feel like most artists, you have points in your career where you're like, oh, I should just quit art and do this other thing. So I would always be like, oh, I should quit art and like study history. But eventually I got to a point where I was like, oh, I can study history via art.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly I feel like I would be a terrible historian, because I'm interested in questions that don't necessarily have explicit answers, like, you know, the connection, like, there's no connection between the molasses flood and slavery, except in my mind, really. That there's this conceptual connection that,
yeah, it's the cost of capitalism, like,
yeah.
There's always somebody that's getting screwed in capitalism. Like, we may not see it anymore, but, you know, there's people in Bangladesh that are making their shirts.
Exactly. Dying in terrible factory fires.
Yeah.
And
China and stuff. Like, that's why we can afford the things we can afford, is because they're making it for free, basically.
Yeah. And that there are these, that it's so easy to shut those things out. You know, even if it's not happening on our shores, you know, and even though we're all connected in so many ways, we can still, like, not see them, so.
Mm-hmm.
But that is interesting, because it's, like, still happening, and that's what I...
That's the only way there's profit to be made, because
yeah.
if you do things ethically the whole way through, you're probably not going to make a whole
lot of
money.
No. Which is so odd, because you think about art where we don't make any money. I'm speaking for myself. Where the economics are totally turned on their head, and you put so much time and labor to something that you know isn't, you know, you're not going to make a real return on it. So.
Yeah. Anyway, I derailed you from talking about the yarn piece.
Oh, yeah, definitely. So that piece had text from Encounters of the New World. There was one from Columbus, the Vinland Sagas, and Lewis and Clark's journal. So the one from Columbus said, let's see, and the air was as sweet and soft as Seville in April, such that it was pleasant to breathe it, I believe, or delightful to breathe. I can't quite remember. But that was his impression of, you know, coming. I guess he was in the Bahamas then. And
mm-hmm.
and then with the Vinland Sagas, it says, the ground was covered with dew, and they got it on their hands and put it to their lips, and it was the sweetest thing they'd ever tasted. talking about Vikings coming to Newfoundland.
Mm-hmm.
And then the final quote from Lewis and Clark, even though it's not necessarily an encounter with the New World, they're coming to the Pacific Ocean. And I felt like it was a comparable, you know, a rediscovery of the continent in some ways.
Mm-hmm.
It just says, Pacific in view, oh the joy.
Yeah.
So for me, that piece where it had three bottles, and out of the bottles were spilling string, and the string became words on the floor. It was sort of imagining like the thread as water, and you know, I don't know, maybe metaphors for history and time, and then forming these words that were these encounters via water. And I'm thinking of following up on that with a similar piece about the Salem witch trials.
Mm-hmm.
Again, where strings become words. And now I'm sort of also thinking about string and fate. Like there's, you know, the strings of a man's fate that get cut by the fates. So in exploring that, and also the tradition of the red string of fate or destiny, which would be like a string that would be tied around two people's ankles, and they would sort of get brought together for a certain point in their lives. So I guess I'm thinking about that as well in the sort of side thing. But I guess they're all sort of related, the thinking about, you know, recasting American history in this mythic way, because I think that that is the best way to see American history, because that's somehow the way that America sees itself, that it's full of myth, and that even though it's so, you know, practical, it's set off by this sense of, you know, shining cities on hills and promised lands into which we, I don't know, we fill and multiply and such.
Yeah, that sounds like Salt Lake City.
Yeah.
Mormons, when they got there, they thought they had found the new site for the new Jerusalem.
Yeah.
And
yeah. And I feel like that it wasn't just them.
But they originally thought that it was Independence, Missouri, which is now the meth capital of the world.
Really?
So, yeah. There's like the huge Mormon temple there. Joseph Smith didn't actually make it to Salt Lake City. I think he made it to Independence.
Yeah.
And he was like, this is where the original Garden of Eden was. We're going to set up here. And then they got ran out of town.
Oh, my gosh.
And he was killed in, like, Illinois later. And then Brigham Young took them all out
to
Utah so they could escape the persecution of society.
I should read some more about that, because I feel like that so much sums up what is really interesting. Like,
it's a really weird and interesting story, like the creation of Mormonism. And some of the weird stuff they believe, like... Joseph Smith would go out in the woods and, like, talk to God, and he's like, which is the true religion? And he was like, none of them are. You need to make your own.
I think that sums up American history kind of perfectly. That it has both industriousness and, I don't know, biblical mythology combined together, as well as frontier culture and manifest destiny.
Yeah.
And what's more, I guess, biblical than manifest destiny. So, but yeah, so I'm very excited about this body of work, and I just feel like it. Every time I like you were just saying about Mormonism, like, oh, that's another thing to do. So I feel like I just hit on something very good, and like I never liked American history until maybe a few years ago, where I started sort of starting with that string piece around that time.
Was that like an earlier piece in this vein of work?
Yeah, it was. I mean, I had done it after my previous show in 2011. That's it, 2011.
Mm-hmm.
So about that time I started incorporating text into my work, and that was a little more higgledy-piggledy. Like, I took some text from here and some text from there, and I started thinking about text in terms of just what was close to me, and sort of New England, and then thinking, oh, this is fascinating, moving outwards.
Mm.
So,
was that piece shown by itself, or did you have other accompanying works with it at the time?
It was going to be part of the show that I did, Knowing, Not Knowing, which had a lot of text in it. I just sort of didn't get around to doing that. And then it ended up being in a group show at the Boston Sculptors Gallery called Strand that was all about string. So I was like, oh, well, I had this piece I wanted to do that had string in it. I guess it was a good excuse to do that.
Yeah.
But it was about that time as well. So it did stand on its own, but I saw it as part of that body of work.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And I remember a couple other text-based pieces that were on your website.
Oh, do you want to have a look?
Sure. There was this one on the crosswalk here.
Oh, yeah. That's one of my favorite pieces. Oh, fair.
I remember.
Okay, so what it was I took excerpts from the letters of Robert Browning and Elizabeth Barrett Browning, who were 19th century English poets who had met over poetry, and they corresponded, and they slowly fell in love and eventually eloped, and it was all quite romantic. So on the Davis Square bike path, I took five excerpts from a year of their correspondence, sort of picking apart that process from introduction to sort of declaration of love, and so that And at each, there were five sites, and at each site there was an excerpt. So that walking along the bike path became sort of this narrative experience of going through their relationship. And I did it with tempera paint, just stenciled on the ground so that it would wear away slowly, and over time, you know, it would just be a memory. And I went there maybe, I did it in September and went there in, like, maybe October or November, and it was gone, so...
Mm-hmm.
And I was kind of sad.
Did you just put it up on your own, or did you have to go through a permission process?
Well, I had received a grant from the Somerville Arts Council, and the grant was, you know, basically an award for, I guess, a merit award. But they just stipulate that you give back to the community in some way, and I... Rather than doing like a class or a presentation of some kind, I wanted to do an installation since I like to, you know, build my portfolio when I can.
Mm-hmm.
So working with them, like, they secured the permits and okayed it, and I put it up.
Mm-hmm.
So I think I would like to maybe make that a more permanent piece and do it with spray paint, just so that it lasts a little bit longer.
Mm-hmm.
But I think I'll be doing one in something similar, possibly in New Bedford, with text from Wailing Songs, to mark entrances to water trails for something that's going up. But that is something that's sort of in a haze that may or may not happen.
Right. The vision's forming.
Yeah, exactly. So, but we will see. But that was one of my favorite pieces. I got so many positive reactions from it, and since it was Somerville, a lot of people were like, oh yeah, I know them, Robert Browning, Barrett Browning, yeah. I didn't have to do too much explanation, and I think that, like, a friend of mine, she had some deaths in the family recently, and she found the piece and found that, you know, very meaningful at that time, and she didn't even know that I did it, and was so I was really pleased that she had this reaction to it and was able to find some sort of, I guess, connection to her experience in some way.
And you mentioned a while ago that you'd had a show at Montserrat recently, and
yeah.
I do remember seeing some of your stuff there, and as I recall, there were some pieces that were similar to the book you showed me, where you had, like, really tiny text written out, but it was not historical subject matter, if I remember correctly. Was it, like, the names of stars
or
something?
Yes. I have... This is sort of, like, a side thing.
Also an interest in astronomy.
Yeah. I guess... Well, not so much astronomy, but I'm really interested in space and thinking about what is out there, and that's... That astronomy is in some ways related to faith and art, in the sense of imagining other life as being related to faith, that you don't know that it's there. Like, it's my version of faith. I am, you know, an atheist, but I still, the thought of there not being life out there, I find you know, very disturbing. But I'm like, but there might not be. There's no reason to think, like, there's no proof. So, like, I feel like I go through that same experience that some people do, you know, with their religious faith. So, for, I had two pieces related to that, or several, I would consider them two different sets. There was one piece that was called The Great Beyond, and it was 16 feet, 8 feet going across the floor and 8 feet going up the wall, sort of two isosceles triangles, and it was made up of thousands of pieces of torn black paper on which I wrote in white ink, "Hello, we are here, where are you?" And that it had this wonderful scintillating quality that I looked at it, sort of shifted and didn't quite come into focus, sort of like the night sky and imagining, are the all of these people out there, people that, I don't want to, yes, I don't want to be anthropocentric, sort of all wondering, are they alone and calling out? And then there were a set of drawings, again, white text on black paper, where I wrote out the names of stars very, very small, and again, in white ink, so that, and the ink was sometimes thinner and sometimes thicker, so it would be like a bright white or a light gray, and again, it had that sort of scintillating quality, and they were the names of stars taken from the Henry Draper catalog, which lists them as a 1-to-6-digit number. So... And this was just a selection. The Henry Draper catalog has thousands and thousands and thousands of stars. And then paired with that drawing, I also had the names of all the exoplanets that, at least up until the time that I'd done the drawing, which was in 2011, and then the names of all the known terrestrial planets. So one was a very narrow strip, which was the exoplanets, and then one was... again, a very narrow strip, but just a little like 1-inch square of the terrestrial planet. So taking all the stars and like the massiveness of that that quantity, and then you know, narrowing it down to this strip, and then narrowing it down to this little chunk.
Just showing this small little space where people or
things
could exist.
Yeah, exactly, and thinking about that in that way and those connections, and I don't know how that fit. I do know how it fits into the body of work that I'm doing now. Like, it has that same sense of, you know, mythic and epic, but also sort of grounded in a reality and taking a something that is known and concrete, but also but applying a, I guess a fanciful imagining to it, but also very minimal.
Yeah.
So.
What are some of the other pieces in that show? I don't recall that many of them. Was there one that has things dripping from bottles?
Yeah, I did. I don't do so many drippy pieces anymore. Mostly,
that used to be a thing.
Yeah, I'm over that now. But what it was I had some glass funnels filled with black Sumi ink, and then I had put... dip the tips in rubber and put a small hole in them so that they could drip slowly. Some of them dripped faster than others. Some of them, like, didn't drip at all.
Mm-hmm.
And then I had a bed of salt beneath. So it became, like, this an active drawing that changed over the course of the installation. And that was something that I was very interested in. I began... did a whole series of things that were more about actions and interactions and things changing over time, and that is really interesting, but it's also it's just riddled with problems. Like you know, like you get some, you just don't know how they're going to react. Like there's like with that piece that I did, you know, some would drip really, really fast and they would make a big mess, and then some would not drip at all. And I did something similar in my previous show where I had the same funnels, but I had beds of paper underneath to sort of to make it more like a drawing, and it was it was so problematic because it was like I'd have to go in like every other day and either refill the funnels or I had to clean out the bottoms, and you know, I think those drippy days are over.
Yeah.
For now, at least. But I do really like him. You know, like, one looks back on one's work nostalgically, and it's like, oh, I wish I still did those.
Process pieces like that that you had done, that was just one example.
Yeah, so I had done, again, with ink, and this kind of got me on my kick with paper, that I had spheres of paper mache that I coated the interior with wax, and I made small holes in the bottom and filled those with ink. And they would drip through just that one hole, and it would soak the paper around it,
mm-hmm.
so that they went from these white spheres to sort of these stained black spheres, and they would drip on to a bed of salt beneath. And I only use salt because it's cheap. Like, it's the best material. And you can throw it away when you're done and not feel bad about it. But that sort of was one of those things, like, what can I do on the cheap? And
yeah.
I've also done pieces with fire, again, using sort of not paper mache, but clay mixed with paper shells that I filled with coal and then set the coal on fire, so that the shell would, you know, go from this white chalkiness to, you know, scorched black. And that's even more problematic than drippiness. So, but things that were maybe more successful for knowing, not knowing, I did an installation with edible paper where I had small squares, almost like a business card size, on which I had embossed the names and dates of birth and death when available from grave markers at the Harvard Yard burial ground, and people could eat the paper. So that it was this very geometric grid with these hanging pieces of white paper that would become gray at certain angles, and it was really lovely, and people would take pieces away, and it changed over time, and that's a more fun process for me because there's no I can open it up without disaster.
What flavor was the paper?
It was paper flavored, actually. I was told it tastes like communion wafers.
Okay. What made it like edible, like what was
I think it was like a rice paper. Okay. So it was a little bit sweet. Mm-hmm. It was actually quite tasty, I thought. Like, if I was sitting at the gallery, I'd be like, I want a snack. So I'd munch on them.
That reminds me of a piece you did where I was called Extinct, where you had a bunch of different animals printed on pieces of paper. It was on some kind of form, and people were invited to take them away and illustrate the disappearance of species. And
yeah.
Was that kind of the idea behind the edible paper project, too? Using birth and death dates of people?
Mm-hmm. I think it's... Let's see. In some ways, it's a little bit muddy that the communion piece for me was not so much about, like, the taking away. Like, that was almost a separate element. It was more about eating it and communing with that individual. Like, there are all these things that, like, you know, you put it out there and you think it's one thing, and then as it exists, you find other things about it.
Mm-hmm.
Like, aside from the communing with the dead, that I noticed it became this changing painting. Whereas the extinction piece... That started out in a weird way. Like, I wanted people to take these things and to sort of maybe think about... they were taking the species and sort of... They were both giving it new life, but taking it away at the same time. And that the idea that all would be left would be this white rectangle if everything was taken away.
Mm-hmm.
So... It was sort of about that process, and that, which is, I don't think, entirely clear. Like, that it doesn't have, like, an exact meaning in and of itself. It's the fuzziness, I think, is like, oh, what am I really doing when I'm taking this? That, you know, like, it's almost like an exercise. Like, I'm not sure I had that worked out when it was made. That, mm-hmm. And it was something that I sort of thought about as people were doing it.
Yeah. Learning process for you. As
yeah.
Well.
What do they call that? Like workshopping in like theater scenes.
And one thing I just kind of realized was that in the Extinction piece, it's also kind of dealing with the destruction,
yeah.
destructive force of humans, like you're working with now, but in a much more expanded way.
Yeah.
Than recent works.
Oh, suppose. That's so true. That that. But like that's like the interesting thing, that it's sort of like it's lovely that you participate with the piece and that's
mm-hmm.
what you want to do, you want to engage with it, but by engaging with it you're destroying it.
Mm-hmm.
So
there was another thing you did where there was some kind of design of paper like out on in the grassy
oh, yeah.
field or something, and people were invited to take them away.
Yeah.
What was that one?
There were two ones like that. One was called Bloom. That was when I first started using paper and text, and it was a field of white cut paper flowers, very, very simple, on bamboo scooters, and it was in a circle with a red ring center, and people were invited to take the flowers. And originally that was like, it was more about it changing over time and it being there and then it not being there, and also partly like, oh, I don't have to store it when it's done, like, and I don't have to take it down when it's done. So, and that was about more like it transforming over time. And then there was a second version of the piece that I did with the names of women who had worked in the factories in Lowell,
mm-hmm.
written on the flowers, and it was a similar setup, and people were invited to take the names, and that was more almost like the communion piece, where it's like you're thinking about the individual and you're taking them with them, and it's sort of you having a moment with that individual. But you asking these questions is sort of like making me think about how I'm inconsistent with what I mean by each time you take something.
Mm-hmm.
That sometimes you're completing the piece. I mean, it's always completing the piece by taking it, but that sometimes it's a... it's more destructive, and sometimes it's more, you know, meditative on the thing that you're taking, and that
doesn't always have to be the same.
No, but it
different interpretations. Of
yeah,
and
that it's like the same action, but it means different things. And I mean, I'm okay with that. But it's sort of pointed to the fact that I have this incoherent language.
If you really get down to thinking about it philosophically, like, to exist we need to take things in
yeah.
for ourselves, but there's consequences of that taking.
Yeah.
Our
yeah
choosing to live, and we can choose to take more than we really need, and
yeah,
what consequences does that have? So.
And it's so funny that you sort of like phrase it like that, because it's also like that, I mean, there's that, and it's almost like I wish somebody would take more things, because then it's like I have less things that I have to deal with. Like,
mm-hmm.
I sort of, that there's that practical aspect like to it as well, that there is the whole, there is the metaphor about it, and that you can continually read into it, and that, but then there's me who's like, I just don't want to take it down. Please take more, but then it's also, you know, like, do you take more? And, you know, like, breaking down that wall of interacting with the art and
mm-hmm.
Thinking that you can take it and make it yours. And certainly that's not... I was talking to someone about showing at a commercial gallery, and I was like, oh, and I could do this piece where people take things. And she's like, no, no, Hannah, that's not how it works.
You can't give this stuff away, we gotta sell it.
Yeah, yeah. So I guess that's another way of thinking about it too, is art is
yeah.
commodity, but not commodity.
Yeah, a lot of it seem to be not commodity, where you're inviting them to just take it. So.
Yeah. And I guess that's...
That's kind of how a lot of, like, performance or
mm-hmm.
conceptual stuff is. It's not geared to make money.
No. And
because you can't sell an idea that easily, you can just tell someone it.
Yeah. And it's odd for me, because I feel like that's the piece, that is how it exists.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and then there's but then there other people look at it and they're like, but why are you doing this for free? Like, why, like, or why are you giving that away? And certainly, I mean, I had, when I first started showing work, I had this feeling that I had to make something that was saleable. But then it was like I wasn't making the art that I wanted to make, so it was like I was trying to make it saleable, but also trying to make the work I wanted to make, and it wasn't the right thing for either one of those in the end. So.
And I remember there were several pieces documented on your website we haven't really talked about. There was most of the stuff I think saw didn't have text in it.
Mm-hmm.
There was several. I remember one off the top of my head. There was like jars with like kind of paper structures in it, and there was a lot of kind of paper structure things.
Oh, the ones with the skulls, that were like antlers.
They looked like trees or antlers.
Okay,
or
yeah. I had done that at a residency in Budapest, and
is that like older work and all the new? We've already talked about all your new stuff.
Oh yeah, but let's talk. But that was such like that was one of those pieces that one does sort of like tangential to anything else and was kind of fun and, you know, is kind of like endearing where you're like, oh, you don't fit with anything, but I really like you. but when I was in Budapest, I noticed that like a lot of museums or even the hotel I was staying at, they had walls and walls of trophies of antlers. And there were just so many of them, and that I work with the artist that I work for is Hungarian, and he had had this experience where after the war they had all this furniture like and things like hunting antlers that they had in their grand houses, but then they would move into tiny apartments, so they had all this huge furniture and these huge antlers that they were trying to cram into this tiny space. And I felt like that in some ways really you had this very old war world, almost aristocratic perception, and then you had of hunting, and then you had this other layer of communism that sort of like cut over that, and then you had the two sort of trying to fit together, and one was sort of being constrained, and those pieces were these fanciful paper cutouts of like if you had a little deer skull and it had grown inside of a jar and had filled it up in some strange way that. It like a bonsai deer almost. And so that was sort of like my perception of Hungarian culture, that it was this ornate thing that was getting sort of like crammed into this tiny space, and I mean of course it was that it was influenced by those things that I was seeing, but then it was also like, oh, I just enjoyed extrapolating off of that. And it was called preserves, and I was like, oh, it's like a nature preserve, and it's also like jelly. And those were really wonderful. I might make some more of those for kicks. And I actually had done a set of those. They were just cut out, and they just hung on the wall, and they were very, very tiny, so it was almost like, it was an anti-trophy. So, like, aside from, like, being this huge deer, it was a tiny little paper sweet one. And the other artist that I worked for, she saw them, and she's like, Hannah, you should make these large and out of plastic. And I was like, no, they need to be tiny and delicate and ephemeral.
And so you said that was kind of an anomaly piece.
Yeah.
But, what were some of the more typical things you were making before you started doing the text-based?
Well, I had done, at the museum school, I had focused a lot on ceramics, and I was doing installations with, let's see, sort of anthropomorphic sea life ceramic forms that were, you know, they were very bodily. And so I had a very strong interest in multiples. So it was, I did a lot of work with that, and that was sort of my school experience. And then going off of that, I was thinking, sort of trying to do it out of school and using a lot of unfired clay, and making forms with clay and plaster and paper pulp. So things that were more nest-like or hive-like that were not as refined. Like I did a piece called Nesting, in which I made forms that looked kind of like wasps' nests, like they had the same color, but they were almost like these they had their own life and gesture to them, and I had them installed underneath McGrath Highway, not too far from here.
Mm-hmm.
And that, I think, was much more like the work that I was doing right out of school that... and it was like, so starting from that, it was... And then I would be like, oh, well, I have this material that I like, so that sort of led to the fire pieces for First Night, where I'm working with paper pulp and unfired clay, and going from that kind of process to the dripping ink process. So, and then like ink and paper text. So that was sort of the way things went. And now that I have the text, I feel really good about it. Like before, I feel like I was kind of struggling with, like, I had all these ideas that I thought were very interesting, and so few of them filtered into my work. In some way, like, I see those as like unnecessary steps that had to be taken, but
yeah,
like that
evolutionary
process.
And
certainly, like, my early ceramic work from school, I have a fondness for, because I'm like, oh, those were very well crafted, Hannah, and you did a good job with your glazing. I almost wish that I had stayed doing that, because I think that they're nice objects.
Mm-hmm.
And if I was smart, I would continue making nice objects, but...
Yeah. Well, I'm out of questions for you. If there's anything you wanted to follow up with?
No, not particularly. I mean, I talked about how much I love whaling and how much I love Manifest Destiny, so I think I...
Avid whaler, Manifest Destiny.
Yeah, yes. But I find that that is a off-putting thing when people ask what you're into and you say whaling. And if you know too much about whaling, they...
We won't judge you.
Okay.
We know the whole story.
That's good.
Thanks for talking with me.
Thank
good
you, Matt. Oh, thank you so much.
And that concludes this episode of Studio Sessions with our guest Hannah Verlin. You can find her work online at hannahverlin.com. You can also learn more about me at my website, mattcoleman.com. If you'd like to support this program, you can send a donation through PayPal to studiosessionspodcast@gmail.com. Even if you only send $1, your donation helps guarantee I can continue providing interviews with interesting artists for your listening pleasure. And of course, don't forget to visit bigredandshiny.com for future episodes, along with other arts and culture content. Thank you for listening, and see you next time on Studio Sessions. Mm-hmm.